Once more unto the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen. This is another episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, today starring Jake McClure. Jeff McClure is still out. He will be back and joining us at some point in the future. This is an unknown date. Hopefully not too far in the future. Hopefully sometime between now and November, but possibly November. Anyway, he's doing a lot better. And for those of you who have been worried about him, keep on worrying, keep on praying. He's doing better, but he needs the support. So thanks for that. All right, let me tell you who we are, or who I am. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and not coincidentally, that is the same name as a SEC-registered investment advisory firm out of Salado, Texas. We do business there and give fiduciary advice to the public. And the principals of that firm are generally the same people on this radio program. That's not coincidental. We do this as a service to the public, and what we do during our weekdays is as a service to our clients. If I say something that is absolutely absurd and beyond the pale, you don't like what I'm saying, then you can report it to the SEC. That's who regulates us, and you should keep the complaints to the realm of damage to the public or fraud or something like that, because if it's only about silliness, then you won't stop complaining the whole episode. All right, so what do I have to talk about this week? Got a lot of stuff to talk about. We were going to talk about what happened in the market. I'm going to spend some time talking about the nature of money. And you kind of may say, duh, this is an investment or financial or economics program. But the nature of money is something that people have a lot of confusion about. What is it? We're going to go into some detail on that. In the meantime, if you would like to join me and add to the conversation, because this is going to be a two-hour monologue otherwise, the phone number to call in here is 773-1400. That's the area code is 254-773-1400 if you would like to add to the conversation. All right, so what's happened this week? The S&P 500 stock index, which we don't recommend as an investment vehicle, even though there are some vehicles that try to track it. We do occasionally when it's the only thing available for people in, for instance, 401ks, employer-sponsored plans and things, we do sometimes recommend it. But generally not, because it's an index. It's not designed to hold the best managed companies. It's designed to hold the biggest companies. And that's not generally a good reason to buy something. It's big. Let's buy it. But as an index, it does a good job of measuring the movements of the market. So, and it's one that's widely tracked and listened to by lots of people. So it's a good reference point. What did it do this week? All right, it was up from Friday to Friday, close of business to close of business. It was up a huge 0.17%. Nothing really to write home about. We have seen an incredible amount of lack of volatility during this election cycle. It's very unusual in a presidential election. Unless you're looking at a presidential election, that's fairly well, one of the candidates is fairly well ahead of the others in the polls. And it doesn't matter which candidate is ahead. And this is something I was just saying to Ed as he was leaving, that quite often we tend to assume that because the market says something or does something, it's predictive of who's going to win. The problem is that the market's not a Republican and it's not a Democrat. The market is a bunch of people, some of them with lots of money and some of them with smaller amounts of money, some of them just adding volatility because they want to buy a boat or a house, and some buying volatility because they're afraid of the election decision, whatever that is. So it's hard to be predictive with the market. What I can tell you without any lack of confidence is that when the race is close, we get a lot of volatility. The market, that's you, That's me. That's everybody in America, basically. Even if you are just an employee of one of the companies in America, you're involved in the American economy. And that generally means that in some way you're involved in the market. It may not be the stock market. It may be the small business market. But it's all the same economy. And when we don't know what to plan for in the future as business people, we get uncertain. We get scared. We say, this is too much to think about. And there tends to be volatility. So when you see the presidential election polls and they're getting closer together, Donald Trump in this case would have to gain some popularity or Hillary Clinton to lose some. Neither of them are very popular, so it doesn't take a whole lot to move the polls around. But Hillary Clinton has been consistently, at least for most of the time, ahead in the polls. When she loses some of her popularity or Donald Trump gains some, it causes instability in the market. And there are a lot of Democrats out there that say, well, this means that the market wants Hillary Clinton to win. And that'd be the same as me saying that the market wants Donald Trump to win. It doesn't make any sense because the market isn't a single voice. It's a lot of people. And a lot of people that are deciding to do things with money. What it means when the election gets close, when the polls are getting closer together, volatility picks up because people don't know which president to plan for. Business people, just like economists, eventually have to just say, I may be able to continue complaining about whoever gets elected. I may be able to continue to complain about a given law. But once it's enacted, once we have somebody elected, once we have a law passed, whatever it might be, if we just complain about it and don't follow it, we don't stay in business very long. When the president's elected and they have a bunch of things they're trying to do, we start making measurements of how likely it is that each of those things are going to happen. And we do it, all of us do it. It guides our decision making into the future. And some of us do it intuitively without a great deal of extra thought. We just make the assumption, okay, this is going on into the future. So the market, you, me, and everybody else involved in the economy don't like uncertainty. The market doesn't like uncertainty. And when we get uncertainty, when we don't know what's going on, we get volatility. What does that mean? Does it mean that the market is predicting something? No more than the market predicts the winner of the Super Bowl. Because it's really the teams on the field during the Super Bowl that determines the outcome. Just like it's the candidates and the words that they use that determine the outcome in the political election. Some of that, it doesn't matter if Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton say the worst thing in the world, some of their followers are going to vote for them anyway. That's just the way politics works. However, the swing voters are the ones that make the decision. And this year, the swing voters are the largest of the three groups. You've got Democrats hardcore, you've got Republicans hardcore, and then you have the undecideds or the independents, the ones that are trying to decide based on the merits of the candidate. That's the same makeup that you see in the market. So it's the same people in the market. It's constantly humorous to me when people say, what is the market saying about, and I kind of go, well, that's kind of like going to the Super Bowl and listening to a crowd. At the major points of the game, you can tell something major is going on by listening to the crowd. But you need a lot of other input to figure out what they're trying to say. And that's the point with what the market, quote, predicts an election or a sports team outcome or any other thing that a lot of people try to say is a predictive factor. It's really nice, but in science, there's a long saying it's been around for a very long time. Causation is not correlation, and correlation is not causation. If two things correlate regularly, that doesn't mean that they caused each other. The suicide rate and the popularity of a sitcom could be correlated, but that's not the cause of suicides, nor is it the cause of the popularity of the sitcom. So At some point, we have to say, what's the link between the two? And with the market, the link is not apparent yet. There may be some predictiveness, but if somebody can figure that out, if somebody can figure out how to predict the market, you wouldn't hear them posting about it. They would just be fabulously wealthy. Okay, so the market has moved, not very much, because one of the candidates is ahead of the other candidate. And you should expect the same if it were reversed. There'd be volatility in the point where they're changing who's popular. But once one candidate started being ahead, you would see the volatility start dropping in the market again. And a lot of the lack of volatility is waiting, because even though the polls are not particularly close, they're still well within the realm of error in the polling. The Electoral College is not popular. It's not the popular vote. So determining who's going to win in the Electoral College is a lot harder than figuring out who's the most popular candidate. And that means that there's some uncertainty there anyway, and it causes businesses to postpone investments in their own things, in their own capital items. If they're about to buy a big piece of equipment, they may wait a little bit. If they're about to hire a lot of people, they may wait a little bit. They don't know what the environment's going to be in a year. And I've said this in the past, it's hard for some people to understand because it's the opposite of what the typical viewpoint is. But big businesses and small businesses feel the same way about laying people off or firing people. It is the worst possible thing by far that a business can have to go through, to lay people off or to fire people. Not because the people have been underperforming. That's sometimes kind of fun. If somebody's really, really been doing a horrible thing, it's a relief to the business to say, get out of here. But that's the rarity. That doesn't happen very often. And people that have that happen to them generally don't get unemployment. So when we're talking about downsizing a business, not because the employees are being horrible, but because the profits aren't there. The management isn't able to be nimble enough to change with the environment, or the environment's enough of a change that there's nobody that could make a profit in something. Then they have to lay people off. And that's the sort of thing that keeps managers up at night. How do I avoid doing this? When you're about to hire someone in an uncertain environment, you don't know who's going to be president and which of the two very different economic plans are going to be coming in, it slows down the hiring process. We don't know which way to go. And if you just think in the mind of a small business owner, if you don't know if there's going to be an extra tax for having an employee, or if there's going to be a credit for having an employee, you're going to wait until you know. And if neither of those two rumors even exists, then you hire like normal. Right now, the rumors are everywhere. What's going to happen? Who's going to do what? They're both talking about jobs. They're both talking about the economy. So everybody's waiting. And there's this atmosphere of stillness, waiting for the other shoe to drop, waiting for good news or bad news to make a decision. And the end result of that is that a lot of pent-up demand is building. Whomever is elected, we should see a nice economic response, because we've been having good economic signs, the things that we measure to say whether or not the economy is doing well or not, have been good for the past 6 months. And yet we've been waiting. So all of that goodness, the extra profits that aren't being spent, the people that are being hired at a slow rate, but being hired, that are being trained, are having income, and that's going to come into purchasing power. There's a report that was just out about poverty and about how the rich keep getting richer and the poor keep getting poorer. Well, we've just had an update to that report. And for the first time since the Great Recession, we're seeing a reversal there. But as an economist, that's something that I've been predicting for a long time. Once people start getting hired, once the money starts moving again, once banks start loosening up the credit just a little bit to allow people to get loans on houses and so on, spending is going to start up again. And so we have consumer confidence at the highest point since the Great Recession. And we have the poverty level going down for the first time since the Great Recession. These are two different reports put out by two different institutions, but it's not coincidental that they're saying the same thing. Because as more people get hired, they make more money. That means they're not poor anymore. That's what's going on in the economy. And that means that the market's job, your job in the market, is not to say who's going to be the next president. That's not why you invest. If you said, I'm going to invest for retirement because I think Hillary Clinton's going to be president, I would say that's probably not the best reason to invest. Or I'm going to invest for a long-term business proposition because Donald Trump. No, that's not why you invest. Think how you invest and multiply it out by the rest of the country. You may be nervous about who's elected, but you're still likely to stay in the United States no matter who's elected. And there, every time we have a presidential election, there are threats from one side or the other that if fill in the blank is elected, I'm leaving the country. And it never really amounts to much because the people that said it wind up putting some ketchup and hot sauce on their hat and eating it because they're not really planning on leaving the country. It's pretty expensive. The market predicts long-term based on what the economy's doing. So it's not really a predictor. It's a status quo. What's happening now? That's a good readout in the market. The market is pretty bad about predicting what's going to happen in the economy next month. There's a great saying that the market predicts 9 out of every 4 recessions. And you can measure it in different ways, and sometimes it's 7 out of every 4. But you're still looking at the market as being not a very good future predictor, even of the business environment. Because most of the people investing in the market aren't business managers. We all have good information available. But a lot of the information that we have available to us is based on what's already happened, not what's about to happen. It'd be nice if people would just send us a letter and say, hey, next week the economy is going to look great. That's not how the economy works. It's not how predicting the economy works. We can look at the indicators and we say when people are ordering more equipment or when pre-sales are up, that's good news for the economy because those pre-sales generally lead to actual purchases, which actually leads to profits and so on. And that's good for predicting. There are a lot of things that cannot be predicted, and it's worse than the weather. And the weather's not often as accurate as we wish it to be predicted. So now I've kicked that one around a little bit. It's good and important to know. Now, I wanted to talk about the nature of money. Let me give the phone number one more time. And it's not going to be the only one more time I give it. I'll give it one more time lots of times, which is a little bit of an oxymoron. The phone number in here is 254-773-1400 if you would like to join in on the conversation. All right. First, let me tell you a little bit about why I'm going to talk about the nature of money. First, absolute most basic concept about why we should understand the nature of money is because we use it. And not knowing what it is that we're using is probably dangerous. Second, it will influence your opinion on what's going on in the banking world. Because there's a lot of bad opinion about banking right now. And bankers are never popular. But they're still suffering some pretty negative popularity ratings since the recession. So let's talk about money. And by talking about money, let's go back. Let's go way back. In anthropological digs and studies, we find bartering has been taking place across continents for 20 plus thousand years. We know this because there's flint being used in Western Europe that was dug up in Eastern Asia. That flint was traded because it was really good flint. So just think about that for a minute. The flint is a rock, and it is not particularly light. It's a very dense rock. It can be broken and made into blades. It can be made into arrowheads and spear points. It can be made into skinning implements. So the higher quality flint was like high quality steel of the time. But it's heavy, and they didn't have wheels. So it had to be carried from Eastern Asia on foot without animals to carry it all the way over to Western Europe. That trade, kind of by definition, if you were selling that flint to someone else, you should expect a pretty good payment, whether that's in skins or in food or what. But we know that there is a cross-continent trade going on here that's intercontinental, that's been going on a long time. And flint's really heavy to carry around, so it's not the greatest of currency. But it's the best they had at the time because everybody needed it. So bringing that flint across Asia and across Europe eventually got to be pretty heavy. And then we start seeing the advent of the cowrie shell. It's a little white seashell. It's still used as money today. This is something a lot of people don't recognize. If you go into Timbuktu, a lot of people are still paid in cowrie shells there. Now, there's not a lot of people that live there. It's not a great environment for growing crops or anything. But cowrie shells are still used through Central Africa. They're still used in jewelry in a lot of places. And so it's considered valuable because it's semi-rare. Cowrie shells, however, are hard to control the buying power. So if you are in a tribe, and there's another tribe over there, and you're trying to buy flint so that you can make better weapons because you're at war with that tribe, and that tribe suddenly discovers a bunch of cowrie shells. They didn't work harder. They didn't search harder. They didn't do anything better than your tribe did, except suddenly they have a lot of money, and they can turn and buy a bunch of weapons. So then they turn and they beat you in the next fight. That's the problem with using a commodity as money. And cowrie shells were used widely across Africa, across Asia, and parts of Europe, all the way up to the 1600s. That's not that long ago. This is Isaac Newton time period. This is like the discovery of the mathematics behind gravity. This is pretty advanced stuff. And they were still using seashells for currency. During the Roman Empire, salt was often used as currency. When somebody says they're not worth their salt, that's what they're referring to. Or when someone says salt of the earth, it's because the enlisted and the NCOs of the Roman legions were paid in salt. It's a commodity. Well, what happens to the value of that salt? If you've just worked for 3 years risking your life fighting barbarians somewhere, and you come home and someone has just discovered a new salt mine, your 3 years of pay, which should have lasted you for another 10 years of living in Rome, suddenly becomes very worthless. This is why countries started saying, well, we need to use something that's a little bit harder to find. So they started using gold and silver, sometimes bronze, sometimes copper, because there's skill that's needed to refine it. It's a lot harder to do than just going out with a shovel in a salt mine. It's a lot harder to do than wandering the beach and finding a treasure trove of cowrie shells. So we started using gold and silver. And there's a lot of people that say we should go back to the gold standard. And my question for them is, why gold? Why not cowrie shells? Why not salt? They're all commodities, and the technology for finding it keeps getting better. Whether it's gold, cowrie shells, or salt, we're getting better at finding it. There's better ways of doing it, and we don't have any control over who uses that technology. So the buying power of that commodity is fickle. It changes with the technology for finding it. It changes with how many people are out looking for it. It's the reason why Sparta was the loser between Sparta and Athens. Sparta had a much better army. Sparta had much better training. It had a much more warlike physique and everything else. They had defeated the Persian army on multiple occasions. The Athenians had run away from the Persian army on multiple occasions. And yet the Athenians won the war against Sparta because they discovered a big silver deposit. And they were able to buy a fleet, partially from the Persians and partially from other people. Anytime a commodity is used as a currency, it puts the country or system, in economics we call it socioeconomic system, in danger of someone else finding a larger amount. It doesn't have anything to do with how your system is run, how much rights you give your citizens, whether they're productive or not productive. If a commodity is the reason why weapons can be bought or new technology acquired, then it doesn't matter if you are the best in the world, you become the least. And there's another piece of history to tell you about there, the Celts. The Celts have lots of legends about them. And when they showed up in Ireland and Scotland and England and Wales, the place that we consider that today, there were other people there. There were the Picts. And there are some archaeological evidences of the artwork and sophistication of these people. They had taken bronze work to a level that it's only recently been able to achieve today with the technology we have now. They had the hardest bronze swords of the world. They had art of great intricacy. They had music. They had written language. And the Celts showed up, pretty barbaric, but they had iron. And it didn't matter that the advanced technology was there. A new technology was there, and it took it over. Iron was the new commodity of value. And with iron, they could come and take all the gold of the Picts. So, and that's not the only time in history that's happened. This is why commodities, as a buying force, need to be carefully looked at before we say, let's fall back on that, because we lose our independence if we say our currency is wrapped around a dollar, or the cowrie shell, or salt, or any other commodity. So that's a big thing. Now, all of that was a precursor, because I haven't really said what we use as money today. We're not using a commodity in the same sense. It's not something you can go out and dig up unless someone else buried it. It's human-created money today. It doesn't have anything to do with what the paper's made of, because the mint of any country can change that at any given time. It has to do with the promise written on it. So let's go back to the 1600s again. This is when cowrie shells went away. And the reason why cowrie shells went away is the Dutch, the Netherlands, the English in London were, so Amsterdam and London were the centers of trade at the time because they had a much more freewheeling economy than Spain or France, which had a much more dictatorial concept in their royalty. So there's a lot of trade going on there. And cowrie shells started making a comeback. They're rare. They're pretty. You can make jewelry out of them. There's places that still use it as currency. And at the time, a lot of places used it as currency. So if you could basically get into the foreign exchange market, what we would consider the foreign exchange market today, dollars versus euro, at the time was gold versus cowrie versus topaz versus a lot of other things. That was currency. And the Dutch and the British were buying cowrie, and it was having a big comeback because suddenly there was a big dearth of cowrie shells. We couldn't find them anywhere. And cowrie shells are not particularly durable. They can be crushed accidentally. If you carry them in a bag and you fall down, you may destroy the value of your money. So cowrie shells by nature decay over time, unless they're preserved very carefully. And the ones we find in these old digs are put in special places in hollowed out rocks and in vaults, basically, what we would consider a vault today. So it's really easy to compare what happens with those. And there's markings on the cowrie shells to say how many times they've been moved, kind of like people writing their initials on a dollar bill to see if they ever get them back. So that was going on. And there was a massive discovery of cowrie shells in mid-Africa. Because during that time, there had been some climate shift. It wasn't the same kind of climate shift we talk about today. It was a fairly normal migratory climate shift, and it may have been El Nino, it may have been La Nina. We don't know what it was at the time because we don't have the right records for the time. But what we do know is it became harder and harder to find cowrie shells. The people of England and the people of the Netherlands were buying up cowrie shells, and then a big discovery was made. And lots of ships full of cowrie shells started showing up in the Netherlands. Part of that was new ones discovered, and part of it was you could trade people that had cowrie shells some of your stuff that you didn't find all that valuable that they thought was amazing, and take the cowrie shells and go back up to Amsterdam or to London and sell them on the market. That caused a collapse in the cowrie market. Just like George Soros collapsed the value of the British pound decades ago. This is a scary thing if that's your currency, because suddenly you can't buy things with it. All right, so what do we use instead? At that same time period, the Dutch came up with a really fascinating system. They used gold and silver rather than flint or salt or cowrie shells as their currency. And usually the currency had a face stamped on it, either a king or a queen or a duke or an emperor, something. And they could go back hundreds or thousands of years, or they could be newly minted. And the newly minted ones were more valuable because you knew the quality of the metal and so on. But also because the face of the king on it meant that he would back up that coin. Or she would get, if it's a queen, she would back up that coin. So, coins are being used. They're heavy. The Dutch developed a system of networked marketing where they could buy things anywhere they had a bank of the same company. So if a company owned 9 banks, and those banks were spread across the Netherlands and maybe one in England, then you could write a letter with the appropriate seal put on it to check, to tell them that you had checked that you had in your vault this much gold. So put yourself in the shoes of a banker at the time. Oh, no, let's not do that. They're probably wooden shoes. So let's not go into the Dutch shoes. Just put yourself in the mind of a banker in the Netherlands at the time. You look in your vault. You check to see how much gold you have there. It's not been marked that somebody else has asked for that money. But you check it. You write, "I checked this." And you write a story about who you are that cannot be forged. Somebody is a secret piece of knowledge that only you know and another bank president somewhere else knows. And then you put a really nice fancy seal on it and you send it off in the hands of someone else, because gold is really heavy. It's dangerous to transport. People can stop you. And that piece of paper is only good for the person who it's written to, the other bank. Now, you heard me use the word checked to see that the gold was in the vault. That was the earliest form of the check that we even occasionally still write today. That was when paper currency started to happen. This was paper currency that was backed up by gold in a vault somewhere. And it was a lot easier to carry around than all the gold in that vault. If you wanted to go buy a sea vessel, you could either get a large wagon to carry a large chest with lots of horses and lots of men to ride around you to make sure nobody stopped you and took your gold, or you could get this piece of paper and go to the sea and say, "This paper is good for gold." And they could look at it and tell, "Yep, that paper is good for gold." Now, that caused a lot of security around the paper. If somebody forged that document, it could be bad. We still do that today. That's called counterfeit. So that's the concept that we use for money, with gold behind it. But we're still using gold behind it at that point. And gold is a commodity that other people can find or not find, causing the value to change regardless of what your economy is doing at the moment. When we stopped using the gold standard, it was because the French wanted to hurt us by turning in all the dollars that they had collected over the years and requesting that we send them the gold in the vaults instead. If that had happened, the stability of our currency would have dropped through the floor. We wouldn't have had value to back up a lot of our currency. And that's one of the dangers of having commodities in general. The commodity itself became more and more valuable. But the French had been collecting dollars since before they were valuable. So they turned around and said, here's a bunch of dollars, you give us the gold. We immediately changed the way the currency worked to say it's not backed by gold anymore, and we gave them a bunch of dollars in return. We shredded those dollars and gave them newly minted dollars. The two largest producers of gold in the world are Russia and South Africa. And even in the environment today where a lot of the Republicans are in favor of the Russian government, we don't want the Russian government dictating our economy. And if they've been stockpiling gold and we go to the gold standard and they suddenly release it onto the market, we get runaway inflation. If instead they buy up the gold, then we get runaway deflation. Another country having the ability to destabilize our currency is the reason why we have what's called a fiat currency. When you have a dollar on it, it says it's a Federal Reserve note. That means the banks of our system will give you $1 for every dollar that you give them. That seems a little weird, but it means that we've got to control the quantity of dollars that we have out there. Okay, so where do dollars come from? And I don't just mean the paper ones, because paper ones, they come from the mint. The paper ones, obviously, we know where that comes from. They get printed. They get printed from the U.S. Mint. They're printed on demand by the Federal Reserve banks when they have paper currency that's damaged. They say, let's replace this. But paper money is an incredibly small percentage of the money in circulation. If you think about your bank account, you have a bank, it has money in it. That money right now is electronic. It used to be written on paper with pencil and a piece of graph paper with double-entry bookkeeping. Now it's done electronically with double-entry bookkeeping. It's your money is saved on hard drives, which are backed up on lots of places and shared in a huge network where everybody's looking across over everybody else's shoulder to make sure that they're not messing up in that system. That's one of those things where it's in everybody's best interest that the deposit records are in order and regulated. Because without that, you don't know what you own. You don't know how much money you have. So, fiat currency is more stable than any commodity-backed currency. It can protect the buying power of that currency in periods when commodities are being discovered in other countries. If we are the leaders of technology, and we are, there's no doubt about that. The United States is the leader in technology in the world. And we're going about coming up with the newest everything. We are. We come up with better ways of doing business, better ways of transport, better ways of manufacturing, better ways of you name it. We're coming up with better ways of doing it. And our economy leads the world because of it. If someone else, whose only thing that they do is get lucky and find a bunch of gold, they could destroy all that innovation that we do here. I'm trying to put that in a way because I tend to lean libertarian. And by that I mean I tend to believe that personal rights very strong, and that's what makes up the rights of the whole. That if everybody's personal rights are protected, then everybody's rights are protected. There's not us versus them. It's we each have our own rights and they're protected. But when it comes to a lot of the policies and ideas of the libertarians, they go to this Austrian school of economics of gold's the only way to go to because that's the only stability. That's a myth. It's a legend. It's this concept that gold somehow is magical. that by putting it in a vault that nobody else will find it anywhere else in the world, that the asteroids that we know about that are floating around in space that have more gold or more platinum in them than we've ever discovered on the face of the planet. If you think back to when Spanish ships were carrying back huge amounts of gold from the New World, that caused inflation in the currencies of every country on the planet, including China. Spain influenced the Chinese currency from the other end of Europe. So this sounds a little bit like the Flint concept again. If we each control our currency and don't abuse the currencies of others, things go well. And I've got to play some commercials. I'm on a roll here, and it's hard to stop. But if I don't, then the news and the talk of this station goes away. So Town Square needs me to play some commercials, and I'm going to do so. So if you'd like to call, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. That's locally 773-1400, and I'll be back. And I'm back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400. And we've got some more commercials to play, but I wanted to hit some more on this dollar, what is money concept. How is money created? If it's not created by the mint, which was only paper money is created there, it's created when banks give loans and they're paid back on time. If I have $10 and I loan it to you and I say, when you pay this back to me, you give me $11, that increases my ability to give my next loan. So I can turn and give $11 to somebody else and ask them to give me $1.10 on top of it. So now I've got $12.10. That creates money that I can turn and give to other people. It's a strange concept because you had to earn the money that you made to pay that interest. But the concept of the bank being able to turn and loan it back out, here's why that's important. When you make a deposit at the bank, that's what they use to make the loans. So say you have $10. You give it to me, and I'm going to keep it safe for you. And you say, well, I want a better interest rate on my loan of $10. And I say, well, why did you want to put the $10? Well, I just want some credit history so you know I'm good for it. Oh, okay. Well, next time I'll be easier to give you a loan because I know you paid this one back. So here, $10. I know where this $10 is coming from, by the way. It's coming from your bank account. So $10 goes to you. You go out. You do your thing with the $10, and you come back and you pay me the $11 back. Well, during that time period, if you have that $11 out there, you may come back to me and you say, well, I need the $10 out of my bank account as well. And I, as the banker, say, well, I've got other deposits that are covering your investment, your loan to me of $10, and my loan to you of the same $10. So I'm going to have to come up with $10 to pay you for your deposit. Now, I may charge you a higher interest, but that means that the $10 you gave me that I used again to pay you actually becomes the $20 because I've got to get it from somewhere else. It's a strange concept, and it's one that causes little wigglies to form in the brain a lot of times. But that's how money's created. That extra dollar that you gave me in interest is a new dollar that isn't in the deposits of the bank. It belongs to the bank, and they can use that to make loans as well, or to spend, or to eat with, or any number of other things. So that concept is good. Money disappears when you ask for a loan, and I give it to you, and then you don't pay it back. You pay me $5 back instead of the $10. Well, what do I do with that? I've got other people that need that money when they're getting their deposits. So in the Great Recession, that's what led to the deflation that we've had. Loans didn't get paid back, so new money was not created. In fact, old money was destroyed. And it's a strange system, but the system is based in confidence. Your confidence that the bank is going to have your money. Your confidence that the dollar will be worth something when you take it out. Destroy that confidence, then the dollar becomes worthless, even if it's got good promises on it. Now, it would cause a lot of people to have bad confidence in the dollar to destroy it, because it really is a world currency and the whole world thinks it's great. And I'm going to have to cover more of this next hour because I've got to play some more commercials. Hate having to interrupt this. I know a lot of you are going, "Ah, keep talking," but this is a for-profit enterprise at the station. I'm not getting paid for it, but they sure are. And I want to keep having a program here, so we're going to take a break. I'll be back on the other side. If you would like to call in, 254-773-1400. I'll be back.
If you love gospel music, you'll love.
And I'm back with a real quick before the break. We don't endorse that commercial that came on about banking on self. That's bad stuff. Until next hour, you can call in 254-773-1400. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and I'll be talking at you next hour.
KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood, the best talk in America. News Radio 1400 KTEM.